camp as a receptor for the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that they expelled during the second half of 1948 from the south of Palestine into Gaza, making the Gaza Strip the biggest refugee camp on earth. And the last wave of villages that were forcefully removed and its house burned and demolished were the villages that are today, on the ruins of these villages today, are the Jewish-Israeli settlements that were attacked by on the 7th of October. So you need to know that history for understanding what was going on also on the 7th of October and not just in the Gaza Strip itself. 70% of the people who live today in Gaza, 70% are 1948 refugees. And many of them are from villages and towns which are very near to the Strip itself. Not to mention the fact that the international indifference to the ethnic cleansing in 1948 provided encouragement to Israel to continue the ethnic cleansing in other means after 1948. Because after all, in 1948, Israel succeeded, in inverted comma, only to ethnically cleanse half of Palestine's population. And many of the refugees remained in Palestine itself, in refugee camps in the Gaza Strip and refugee camps in the West Bank. And many others remained in refugee camps near Palestine. So in order to complete the incomplete ethnic cleansing of 1948, Israel continue ethnically cleansing Palestinians, first from inside Israel until 1967, and then after occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, not on the same magnitude as it expelled them during 1948, in a more incremental way, but nonetheless, hundreds of thousands, to my account, about 450,000 Palestinians were expelled from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip between 1967 until the 7th of October, 2023. What I see today is an Israeli decision to use another method in order to complete the ethnic cleansing of 1948, and that's the method of genocide. And the first phase of genocide finished in the Gaza Strip. We don't know the numbers. People are talking about 40,000. But what we hear from United Nations officials about the many bodies under the rubbles, we're probably talking about 200,000 people. And now Israel is moving into a genocidal operation in the West Bank under the pretext of another mythology, that they're actually preempting an Iranian proxy war against Israel. But this is just a pretext for beginning a genocidal policy towards the Palestinians in the West Bank, and I'm afraid that the next station after that are the Palestinian citizens of Israel. This is a messianic Zionist, or as Nur Masalha calls it rightly, a messianic neo-Zionist government that believes it has an historical opportunity to complete the total de-Arabization of Palestine from the river to the sea. And this opportunity will not repeat itself, and therefore, contrary to the way the American administration looks at the situation, are very much in favor of escalating the situation into a regional war, because like the Christian fundamentalists that believe that a huge explosion, violent explosion, a doomsday war, Armageddon kind of war, is part of the divine scheme that opens the way for a different kind of period in the future. And we should take seriously these notions and the way they are being translated into policies on the ground. I would like to finish by talking a little bit about the mythologies that are connected to the future. But I think that one of the major challenges we have in trying to spread the word or to inject a new, an old new kind of dictionary or vocabulary into the way we would like people to talk about Palestine, about the situation today and about our hopes for the future. And some of that language, I'm very happy to say, has been adopted also by the solidarity movement here, by the encampments. And when people ask me what is the difference between the solidarity movement with the Palestinians in the 70s and the one that emerged in the last 10 or 11 months, I say that I think that more clearly the necessary vocabulary is being now adopted and spoken naturally. If these kids were born with this kind of dictionary. And that's very encouraging to hear that. And that is a non-nonsense approach to Zionism as a colonialist project, jettisoning the conversation about peace, replacing it with conversation about decolonization, challenging the Israeli notion of being the only democracy in the Middle East, by referring it to an apartheid state, settler colonial apartheid state, and by adopting a vision that is so beautifully, of course, encapsulated in the slogan, Palestine should be free from the river to the sea. I think this is something that is still a far cry from the way mainstream media, mainstream academia, and mainstream politics are talking about Palestine, especially, as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, all this conversation on the day after is based on the two-state solution. The idea is to create another Bantustan in the Gaza Strip, similar to the one in the West Bank, and somehow hope that this is going to work. God knows where do they find the source of inspiration to think that it should work, on what basis. What books are they reading? Who are they consulting? I have no idea, because so much nonsense being written recently on this. But whatever it is, if we find a way of injecting this conversation with the right terminology, I think we are going to be able to defeat the mythology, both in our academic works, in our activism, in our conversation, and insist that this is the language we should use. We don't use conflict, we don't use peace, we don't use two-state. Two-state solution has been dead for so many years. It's lying in the morgue, everybody is afraid to have the funeral, but it's time to bring it into an honorary burial so that we can all have a closure and move on. And I'll finish. There was kind of a humorous moment in my conversation with the two agents in Detroit, when they asked me, do I believe in the slogan that Palestine should be free from the river to the sea? I said to them that everywhere there's a land between two sources of water, people should be free. Yeah. But one of the guys wanted to show me that he did listen in his geography classes, and he said, what about Bulgaria? I remember he said. I said, okay, everywhere between any two sources of water, I'm sure there is, I haven't looked at the map, people should be free. I really believe that it's time that we will use the same language in our academic courses in universities, stop teaching Palestine in political science department that deal with conflict management and conflict resolution, move it to modules for decolonization, genocide studies, anti-colonialism, and let's defeat the oxymoron, academic courage. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sigil. I'm actually the co-chair of DSA International Committee's Palestine Subcommittee. And DSA is Democratic Socialists of America. We're kind of big tent. And I was curious, you mentioned that there was a time where you also believed in the two-state solution, or two-state delusion, as I like to call it. And we still have some comrades, I think, that believe in that. And so especially especially Jewish comrades. I'm wondering, how can we help have that conversation? If it's like, what was it for you as someone who grew up there, was Jewish? What was it that made it click for you and made you into, you know, so such an uncompromising and staunch anti-Zionist?
As for the question of the two states, first of all, we have to admit that whoever represents the Palestinians today, whether it's the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian political parties inside Israel, they still subscribe to the two-state solution, which is one of the reasons, I think, some members who, or some people who are part of the solidarity movement with the Palestinians would say, why should I adopt a position that those who represent the Palestinian Liberation Organization do not adopt? I'm not more pious than the Pope. And that's a difficult issue. But I do think that it's important to engage with people on the issue itself rather than on questions of who represents whom rightly or wrongly. And if one doesn't see the moral weakness or deficiencies of the two-state solution, namely an idea that relates only to 20% of Palestine, that relates only to half of the Palestinians, that has nothing in terms of solving the Palestinian refugee problem, that is keeping Zionism, be it in only 80% of Palestine, still keeps it, this racist ideology, intact. If that doesn't work, they only have to be 5 to 10 minutes in the West Bank, virtually or physically if they can, and to see that what Israel created in the West Bank is irreversible in terms of a two-state solution. I think it is reversible in a one-state solution. The fact that there are 700,000 Jews living in urban sprawls, not just isolated settlements. The natural growth is such that the number will double itself very soon. It's only if you want to apply transitional justice, which we would have to, through a process of decolonization to places, and not just the people who live in these places. This can only be done in a project that totally de-Zionizes and decolonizes Palestine, not in redeploying the Israeli army in such a way that creates these awful Bantustans that anyone living in the West Bank would tell you that life before Oslo was much better than life after Oslo. Thank you.
Hi, Ilan. I'm a rail worker from Toronto. I'm a big fan. Gaza in crisis was huge for radicalizing me, so thank you for that. I have a question about a narrative. Maybe it's a myth, but this narrative is that models of class struggle and ideas of class struggle don't really apply to Palestine because everybody in historic Palestine, everyone from the river to the sea, is either too privileged to engage in class struggle because, you know, if you're an Israeli, you get free land and that sort of thing. You get free military aid from the U.S. So everyone's either too privileged or too oppressed. Like Gazans, of course, their industry keeps getting destroyed. Like you mentioned, it's like 82% of Gazans are refugees. Within the 48 borders, Palestinians are kept out of Israeli industry. And in the West Bank, one of the only jobs you can get is construction, building the settlements that are settling you out of existence. So this idea is that there's no real revolutionary subject or subject of class struggle because everyone either gets too much or is too oppressed to engage in class struggle. So I was wondering if you think that's a myth.
I'm from St. Louis. My Congresswoman Cori Bush was one of the first to call for a ceasefire. She's been the most pro-Palestinian, one of the most pro-Palestinian congresspeople. So then AIPAC spent $15 million to beat her by, you know, 5% or so, and I'm sure you've heard about this, but to me shows like a sign of desperation to spend that much money and to pull up all sort of tricks just to win by that little amount. I wonder if this is kind of like a sign, I hear you say the beginning of the end of Zionism, if this is kind of a beginning of the end of it, just AIPAC having to go up that far out, and I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that.
What is the strategy we can use to push back so that these AIPAC campaigns to defeat Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush end up having payback so strong that we're going to actually end up helping to defeat and fight AIPAC. We have to make this cost. What are your recommendations?
First of all, about the class struggle in Palestine and the privileged Jewish society, I think it's a more nuanced situation. As a former member of the Israeli Communist Party, I know how we failed to create the coalition we always wanted between the Mizrahi Jews, who were the main component of the Jewish working class in Israel, and the Palestinians, who also were an important part, whether Palestinians from inside Israel or the occupied territories after 67. And it didn't work because of the way most of the Mizrahi Jews were de-Arabized and under the influence of some of their rabbis became probably in large numbers the base for racist anti-Arab policies in Israel. However, I don't think this is an irreversible process. There are a minority, but they exist, of Mizrahi Jews, call them Arab Jews, inside Israel, who definitely can be recruited and be galvanized for a class struggle that will go along the Palestinian liberation struggle and not against the Palestinian liberation struggle. But I do think it's important to analyze correctly the situation of the Israeli economy right now. You have 20% of the Israelis paying 80% of the taxes. Many of them are leaving Israel. They already began to leave Israel before the 7th of October because of the rise of the neo-Zionist messianic political forces to power in November 2022. The economic situation is in crisis, and the gap between those who have and have not does not includes also the Jewish society. It's not just an ethnic demographic issue. It's a classical class issue, and it's not the only place in the world where the left finds it difficult sometimes to recruit the working class against xenophobic, racist policies that are connected in the West to immigration, in Palestine to the issue of the occupation and the colonization. So I think this is something that should not be looked at only as it stays today, but we should allow our imagination to go beyond that. After all, most of the Jews who came from Arab and Muslim countries don't have dual nationalities. They don't have European passports. But they will stay in Palestine after the collapse, and the collapse will come. And they are much closer to the area, its culture, its language, despite 76 years of human engineering that try to disconnect them from their own heritage, identity, and language. The question of the AIPAC success, I do agree, actually, with the second, I didn't write names of comrades, but the second question. I do agree. I think the might used on one candidate or so on is a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of strength. AIPAC is part of a larger I don't have to tell you this, you're here in America, of a larger pro-Israeli lobby. It doesn't include only AIPAC, but AIPAC is an important pillar in this structure. And it's a very veteran advocacy group. It exists more than 100 years. And like all such structures, which are so old, that is, their longevity, also exposes their weaknesses. And the biggest weakness of AIPAC is connected to our work in the left. What I mean by this is the following. If we believe that politics can only be defined the way it is defined by our political elites today, then AIPAC works on a viable model. Mm-hmm. Then it works on a viable model. This is politics. Money buys you victory. It's connected to capitalism. It has nothing to do with the agenda of the people itself. Politicians are there for power, for the sake of power, for their own fulfillment, and so on. But if we believe, and I think we all believe, that, and there were some good indications in France that this is possible, that there can be a redefinition of what politics is. How does politics, or how should politics, represent the agendas of people on ecology, on poverty, and so on? AIPAC doesn't have the tool to deal with such transformation. So because I believe the old kind of politics is not going to sustain for long in a world that faces global warming, poverty, diseases, and where people would have to rely back on human solidarity and intersectionality and all the things and the left had believed in, I think that AIPAC, like the State of Israel, is using force because anything else they would have liked to use, which is moral arguments, human arguments, is not working. It's very clear that you can bomb people with F-16, but not their ideas. And the epitome for this is the Israeli idea that they can wipe out the Hamas in Gaza with a genocide. The Hamas would survive. And unfortunately, a lot of people would pay the price, but the Hamas will survive the genocide of Gaza. It will remain there because political Islamic ideology is the one that seems to so many Palestinians right now as the only one that dares to resist the occupation and not collaborate with it. So it will remain a powerful, valid force as part of the Palestinian liberation movement. And the change in the civil society in the United States, the change in the American Jewish community, the change towards in the attitude towards the Palestinians in Israel cannot be stopped by money, political power, and all the other lethal methods that AIPAC has used over its 56 or 57 years of existence. And it is still effective because we have not yet changed the way politics is being done. But I do believe that this whole structure of politics, the way it has been done here and in the global north, is on very weak and precarious pillars that are shaking. It's like there's extensive cracks in the foundation of this building. Finally, no, there's no finally. I think that's more or less it. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
You were just listening to Ilan Pape on Myths of Israel. Ilan Pape has been called Israel's bravest historian. He's the author of many books, including 10 Myths of Israel. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Thomas Suarez, Michael Parenti, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And we have a series of programs on the Middle East. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Ilan Pape, Myths of Israel, and for his classic book, 10 Myths About Israel, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. Go out with Miles Davis, If I Could Write a Book. Thank you.
Listening to see